Good afternoon. This is Tamara reading the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, December 10th. We'll start on the front page. We have an agriculture article from Southern Illinois titled, Ostriches Give Farmers a Leg Up, from Kim Hill, Illinois Farm Bureau Partners. We have a photo of some of the ostriches. Salger's Ostrich products in Illinois offer a red meat alternative, meeting a need within growing market demand. Consumers with allergy from tick bite flock to ostrich beef. Salger's Ostrich products in Illinois offers a red meat alternative, meeting a need within a growing market demand. When people are encouraged to try an unfamiliar meat, the person offering the new protein often says, "It tastes just like chicken." But Paul Mollett won't ever say that. He chuckles when he's asked if ostrich meat tastes like chicken, because after all, ostriches are birds. Ostrich is closer to beef than any other protein in taste and texture, says Mollett, who runs Salger's Ostrich Products near Redbud with his wife, Erica. You cook it like beef, and it's very similar to a lean beef, except it is lower in fat. Erica and her brother, Nathan, grew up on a farm. Their parents, Kathleen and Fred Salger, entered the ostrich industry after purchasing a neighboring dairy farm at auction in 1992. That 40 acres wasn't enough for a large livestock or row crop operation, so Fred Salger began researching viable ideas for the land. He discovered raising ostriches takes a third of the land and water it takes to raise a cattle herd of similar size. And while both Salger and Kathleen had always raised a few cattle, goats, donkeys, sheep, and chickens, they soon discovered ostriches were a big step in a different direction. In 1994, Salger started with two birds and an incubator in his basement, gradually acquiring more birds over the years to build a flock. Back in the 1990s, raising ostrich was going to be this big booming business where everybody was going to get rich, Salger says. There were a lot of growing pains in the early years. Today, the family business is divided into two divisions. Salger Livestock is the farming side, and Salger Ostrich Products is the retail side. Salger, Kathleen, Nathan, and his wife Patty raise the ostrich flock, numbering about 300 birds on average. Nathan, Patty, Fred, and Kathleen do all the farming, Mollett says. Erica is the primary owner of Salger Ostrich Products, and we run it together after joining the operation in 2019. Salger says one of the greatest challenges in raising ostriches is in the incubation stage. A hen lays an egg every other day on average during laying season, which typically runs March to early October, Salger says. We collect the eggs from the pens every night. Early development is very difficult due to many factors that are out of the farmer's control. If an egg gets rained on or is laid in the mud, outside of the pen, for example, we learn it's not worth our time to try to incubate it, Salger says. Learning the optimum humidity levels and temperature levels has been one of the toughest things over the years. Eggs are placed on a roller tray and rotated for a few days before they are incubated for about 42 days. We have a specialized building for our incubation and hatchery with controlled temperatures, humidity, levels, and sanitary conditions, Salger says. Once you get a chick past 10 to 12 weeks, ostriches have great immune systems. Chicks weigh approximately 3 pounds once hatched. The ostriches are fed a mixture of alfalfa, grass, corn, and soybean meal. Salger and Nathan raise all the hay and corn used in the ostrich feed and mix it on site. They also raise the soybeans that are ground into the soybean meal. Salger's Ostrich Products focuses on the sale of meat products. About 90 pounds of meat can be processed from one bird. Ostrich meat is lower in fat than either beef or pork. It's very comparable to beef filet mignon in that there is very little fat, Mollett says. There are no bones in the meat unless you get wings. And while some consumers purchase ostrich because it carries less fat and cholesterol than beef or pork, the largest market of customers for Salger Ostrich Products is the alpha-gal syndrome community. Alpha-gal syndrome is a serious, potentially life-threatening allergic condition that can occur after a tick bite. Symptoms typically occur after people consume red meat or are exposed to other products derived from mammals. Even though ostrich meat has the appearance of beef, it is poultry, making it safe for those with alpha-gal syndrome. I get daily calls from people around the country who say they've just been diagnosed with alpha-gal, and they found us online. It's unbelievable how many people have it. We try to help people learn more and more, make them aware of what they can eat that we produce. In the 7 years I've been involved with the business, I've learned as much about alpha-gal as I have about ostriches. The farm's offerings include prime-cut fillets, roast, ground ostrich, wings, burgers, and even ostrich summer sausage. We are one of just a few ostrich suppliers that have as many products as we do, Mollett said. Local customers can shop at the farm store located in Randolph County or find Salger ostrich products at select farmers markets in the region. Products can also be ordered from the farm website, SalgerOstrichProducts.com, and are shipped nationwide weekly. Everything gets to its location within 2 days, no matter where it's going in the U.S., Mollett says. The farm's focus is providing fresh, delicious ostrich meat direct from their farm to consumers' tables. We cater to the direct consumer, having the product ready for them to cook at home, rather than selling or shipping to meat markets, Mollett says. This story was distributed through a cooperative project between Illinois Farm Bureau and the Illinois Press Association. Now from Robbie Sequeira, Stateline.org. Education. 4-day school weeks tried. Scarce data on effects. Staff retention sought. Northeast of the capital city of Des Moines, in central Iowa, the 400-student Collins Maxwell Community School District is one of many across the state shifting to a 4-day school week. Like many rural K-12 schools, the district has struggled to find teachers, and it sees the 4-day week as a useful recruiting tool. It also wants to curb student absences, which tend to spike on Mondays and Fridays. The district maintained its traditional 5-day calendar in August and September, but from now on, with scattered exceptions, the middle school and high school in the Collins-Maxwell district will be closed on Mondays. To meet Iowa's minimum number of instructional hours, the district will lengthen the other days during the 4-day weeks. Superintendent Mark Snavely said he watched nearby schools transition to shorter weeks and was intrigued by the reports he got from his counterparts in other districts. Snavely hopes the shorter week will boost teacher morale, reduce burnout, and make the rural district more competitive with nearby districts that are larger and can offer teachers better pay. Ultimately, the why behind the 4-day school week came down to staff recruitment and retention, Snavely said in an interview. We felt being a small school district, the 4-day week would allow us to better compete. He added that surrounding schools with 4-day weeks said they experienced fewer discipline problems and improved attendance. And rural school districts across the country tout the 4-day work week as a way to stretch tight school budgets amid K-12 funding uncertainties at the federal and state levels. But despite the reports of higher attendance and calmer classrooms, education researchers say the evidence tells a more complicated story. Emily Morton, lead researcher for the Northwest Evaluation Association, which creates standardized testing for K-12 schools, cautioned that the promised benefits have not shown up in the data. Moreover, longer school days can harm academic performance, Morton said. But such concerns might not matter as 4-day school weeks become more popular nationwide. One thing that does show up clearly is that there is an extremely high approval rating for these policies, Morton said. Parents and students overwhelmingly want to stay on a 4-day week once they have it. There are more than 2,100 schools in 26 states using 4-day weeks, according to researchers at Oregon State University. In Iowa, the number of districts on a 4-day schedule has grown from 6 in 2023-24 to more than 24 in 25. In Colorado, 2/3 of districts are on the altered schedule. But so far, it's almost entirely a rural phenomenon. To my knowledge, there's not a single urban district using a 4-day week, Morton said. What a 4-day week looks like in a rural community is very different from what people in suburban or urban areas imagine. Dr. Shannon Taylor, an education professor at the University of Nevada, Reno, who studies school scheduling, said districts typically adopt the model for economic and staffing reasons, not academic ones. Rural districts often save money on transportation, utilities, and building operations, she said, and the promise of permanent 3-day weekends helps recruitment efforts. However, the burden of accommodating this transition may fall heavily on parents who work 5 days a week, and especially on the parents of younger students who must find a childcare alternative on the selected day off. The research is still mixed, Taylor said. We don't yet have decisive evidence showing academic benefits or drawbacks. In June, researchers at the University of Oregon published a review of 11 studies on 4-day school weeks, which included data on academic achievement, attendance, discipline, and criminal activity. The impact of a 4-day week varied based on grade level and on location, the Oregon researchers found, but overall, there was no evidence of large positive effects. They also noted that maintaining activities that foster healthy youth development on the 5th day is important for minimizing other negative impacts. In some states, the policy has sparked conflict between state and local officials. There's a lot of tension between state leaders and rural districts over whether the 4-day week is something the state should allow, said Warden. In Oklahoma, when the state tried to take it away, districts simply shifted to virtual Fridays, and instruction mostly didn't happen. The Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs, a conservative think tank, found through a public records request that more than 100 Oklahoma districts had at least one school where students had at least 2 full weeks worth of virtual days in the 22-23 school year. More than 60 districts had at least one school that went online for 3 weeks or more. During many of those days, there was minimal live instruction. In response, Oklahoma this year enacted a law that restricts public schools' ability to shift to virtual learning. The measure limits districts to 2 days of virtual instruction each school year and allows them only under certain circumstances, such as a state of emergency declared by the governor. Missouri enacted a law in 2024 requiring that certain big city charter and county districts obtain voter approval before adopting or continuing a 4-day week. The Independent School District, a 14,000-student suburban system on the edge of Kansas City that switched to the shorter week in 23-24, has since sued the state, alleging the law unconstitutionally targets certain districts based on arbitrary criteria such as county size. Last year, a New Mexico mandate for districts to adopt calendars with more school days was halted in court. An Arkansas legislature has considered a bill that would allow for a range of instructional times from 160 to 190 days, which would be contingent on a school's rating. A large number of rural districts there have moved to 4-day schedules. From Decatur, Tony Reed, police, home invader caught quickly. Justice came quick for an armed man who burst through the back door of a Decatur woman's home with such force she was knocked off her feet, according to a sworn affidavit. As the shocked 36-year-old woman screamed at the home invader to get the expletive out of my house, she had the satisfaction of seeing the man flee out the front door before being tackled and taken into custody in her front yard by police officers. The Decatur Police Department affidavit said the fleeing suspect was Dalton N. Harris, who was found to have a stolen semi-automatic handgun stuffed down the front of his pants when he was arrested on the morning of November 23rd. Harris, 33, is due to appear Wednesday in Macon County Circuit Court for a preliminary hearing when he will enter pleas on charges of home invasion with a firearm and armed violence. He also faces charges accusing him of the aggravated unlawful possession of a weapon, being a felon in possession of a weapon, and criminal trespass with a homeowner being present. Officer Cody Rose, who signed the affidavit, said police had already been in hot pursuit of Harris when he dashed into the home in the 100 block of North Oakdale Boulevard in an attempt to escape. Rose said police had been called to the area after being alerted by a resident who had seen a Facebook post warning of a man in the neighborhood acting suspiciously. Harris was soon spotted by arriving officers as he walked along holding a bag, and Rose said he took off running when ordered to stop. After he was arrested, he was found to be carrying insurance cards that Rose said were stolen from a car parked outside the residence that Harris had invaded. In a Mirandized interview, Dalton admitted he was going around the neighborhood burglarizing unlocked vehicles, Rose added. Court records show Harris had been free on pretrial release at the time of his arrest on a pending charge of having violated probation. Harris had been sentenced to 18 months probation in May after pleading guilty to the possession of methamphetamine. He appeared in court November 24th to be arraigned on the new home invasion charges, but he was denied further pretrial release and sanctioned to 30 days in jail for violating his previous pretrial release conditions. From our food pages today, we have In a Flash, a flavor-packed dinner that comes together in minutes, coconut curry chicken cutlets. This easy chicken cutlet recipe will help you get a healthy meal on the table in just 20 minutes. Coconut milk's creamy consistency is perfect for making quick pan sauces. No need to add a thickener. And red Thai curry paste adds a nice bit of heat to the dish. From Eating Well magazine, a website devoted to healthy eating as a way of life. And from our nutrition page, ready when you are. Have you ever opened the fridge in hopes of using some of the fresh produce you recently picked up, only to find those veggies already rotting? Fruits and vegetables are some of the hardest foods to keep fresh for long periods of time, yet many of us are too busy to consume these products before they expire. Due to the delicateness of some vegetables and exposure to elements that speed up oxidation or spoilage, for example, airflow, temperature, light, moisture, and ethylene production or sensitivity, some vegetables last longer than others, says registered dietitian Sue Ellen Anderson Hayes, owner of 360 Girls and Women. In these instances, it can be helpful to intentionally buy produce known to be long-lasting and store it properly so it stays fresh for weeks. Here are five long-lasting vegetables to enjoy all month long. Number one, winter squash. Despite its name, winter squash is a versatile annual vegetable, something Anderson Hayes recommends when avoiding food waste. Considering other ways to use vegetables, such as adding them to stews, soups, smoothies, gravies, or even freezing them for future use, is a great way to prevent food waste and to save some extra money along the way, she says. Try winter squash in salads, soups, and even roasted on its own. Potatoes. Not only are potatoes a standout resistant starch, meaning they're even healthier when cooked and cooled, they're also relatively resilient when it comes to expiration, Anderson Hayes explains. Just store them unrefrigerated in a cool, dark, and dry place, she adds. Beetroot. Much like potatoes, beetroot is another low-maintenance, long-lasting vegetable that doesn't need to be refrigerated. With a laundry list of nutrients that support cardiovascular, digestive, and muscle health, this anti-inflammatory vegetable will last you through the month. Garlic. Whole bulb garlic can enhance the flavor of any dish and is long-lasting. On the other hand, peeled garlic is best stored in a sealed bag in the refrigerator. When grocery shopping, keep in mind that the whole bulb garlic will last longer and is easier to store than garlic that is already peeled. And last, carrots. Though carrots must be refrigerated, they last long enough to make it worth your while. Storing carrots the right way can lead to fresh produce that lasts throughout the month, plus they make the perfect snack on days when you're still deciding what to make for dinner. Now let's read our first part of our opinion page. Our theme this week is contesting testing. And our first opinion is from Olli-Pekka Heinonen. Heinonen is the Director General of the Switzerland-based International Baccalaureate, an education framework implemented in 1900 U.S. schools. He is author of Learning as If Life Depended on It, and wrote this for Inside Sources. Standardized exams were built for a world that's gone. For more than a century, American education has been driven by the same invisible engine, standardization, rows of desks, national tests, rankings. From the No Child Left Behind policy to statewide report cards, we have long measured success by what can be quantified, compared, and controlled. This model, born in the industrial age, is buckling under the weight of the new world. The challenges facing today's students cannot be solved by scoring higher on a math exam. Climate disruption, mental health crises, the rise of artificial intelligence, and the strains on democracy require a different kind of learning, one that nurtures agency, resilience, ethics, and interdependence. In short, we must challenge past assumptions to imagine an education fit for the future. Today's students are entering a world where few will spend their careers in a single profession. Lifelong adaptability, learning new skills, navigating change, and applying knowledge in a new context have become essential. In such a world, assessments that capture what students know at a fixed moment in time say little about their potential to keep growing. Many education systems are trapped in illusions of modernity, beliefs in simplicity, permanence, competition, and control, among others. These illusions made sense in a previous era, but they are now misaligned with the complexity and fragility of our interconnected world, as I argue in my book, Learning as If Life Depended on It. One of the most damaging illusions is that success can be universally defined and measured. In reality, young people are asking questions. How can I make a meaningful life? How can I make life better for others and the planet? The answers to such questions are not found in class rankings or rigid curriculums. In the United States, the pressures of high-stakes testing and narrow success metrics have contributed to teacher burnout and student disengagement. We also see growing movements calling for change, project-based learning, competency-based assessment, and new models of student voice. These are not fringe ideas. They signal that the old model is approaching its limits. Instead of asking how to improve the current system incrementally, we should be asking a deeper question. What is the purpose of education today? If it is merely to sort individuals into roles in an economy, then we will continue to underprepare them for the moral and planetary challenges ahead. But if it is to help fully form human beings, young people who are curious, collaborative, and courageous, then we must change not only what we teach, but how we think about learning itself. This doesn't mean abandoning structure or accountability. It means being clear about what matters most and designing systems that reward the learning we value. This might involve assessing how students collaborate across cultures, resolve conflicts, and learn from failure. These things are harder to measure, but far more vital. The future of education will not be built by doubling down on past models. It will emerge from those willing to ask hard questions, listen deeply, and redesign for relevance. For U.S. school systems, this is an opportunity not just to reform, but to reimagine. As we move deeper into the 21st century, we must remember that standardized tests were never meant to prepare students for an unpredictable world. They were meant to control a predictable one. That world is gone. Let us build the next one by reimagining what learning can be. We'll read column number 2 from our opinion page in the second half of the reading of the News Gazette, or the Decatur Herald and Review. Now from our National and World page, War in Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Pope Leo XIV waved to journalists Tuesday during their meeting in Castel Gandolfo, Italy. Zelensky refuses to cede land. President reaffirms his stance as he rallies European support. From Paolo Santalucia and Ilyan Novikov, Associated Press, Rome. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky reaffirmed his strong refusal to cede any territory, resisting U.S. pressure for painful concessions to Russia as he moved ahead Tuesday to rally more European support for his country. Undoubtedly, Russia insists for us to give up territories. We clearly don't want to give up anything. That's what we are fighting for, Zelensky told reporters in a WhatsApp chat late Monday. Do we consider ceding any territories? According to the law, we don't have such right, he said. According to Ukraine's law, our constitution, international law, and to be frank, we don't have a moral right either. In an interview with Politico released Tuesday, U.S. President Donald Trump pressed Zelensky to accept the U.S. proposal that Ukraine cede territory to Russia, arguing Moscow has the upper hand in its nearly four-year-old invasion, and that Zelensky's government must play ball. Zelensky met in Rome with Italian Premier Giorgia Meloni, discussing the progress of the peace process, her office said. They emphasized the importance of U.S. and European unity and of solutions that will have repercussions on the continent's security, the statement said. They also discussed developing robust security guarantees to prevent future aggression and maintaining pressure on Russia to join the negotiating table in good faith, it said. Earlier, Zelensky met with Pope Leo XIV at Castel Gandolfo, a papal residence outside Rome. The Vatican said Leo reiterated the need for continuing dialogue and expressed his urgent desire that the current diplomatic initiatives bring about a just and lasting peace. U.S. and Ukrainian negotiators completed 3 days of talks Saturday, aimed at trying to narrow differences on the Trump administration's peace proposal. A major sticking point is the suggestion that Kyiv must give up control of the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine to Russia, which illegally occupies most but not all of the territory. Ukraine and its European allies firmly resist the idea of handing over land. Other than Zelensky's comments, Ukrainian negotiators said very little in public about the content of the U.S. proposal or their attitude towards it. From Jefferson City, Missouri, Associated Press, petition demands vote on Missouri's new map. Over 300,000 signatures submitted in effort to halt GOP redistricting. Opponents of Missouri's new congressional map submitted thousands of petition signatures Tuesday, calling for a statewide vote on a redistricting plan backed by President Donald Trump as part of his quest to hold on to a slim Republican majority in the next year's elections. Organizers of the petition drive said they turned in more than 300,000 signatures to the Secretary of State's office, well more than the approximately 110,000 needed to suspend the new U.S. House districts from taking effect until a referendum election can be held next year. The signatures still need to be formally verified by election authorities and Republican Secretary of State Denny Hoskins, who could declare the referendum petition unconstitutional. A legal fight seems likely. Republican Attorney General Katherine Hanaway said the new U.S. districts, House districts, took effect Tuesday and will remain in place unless Hoskins determines the referendum petition is constitutional and has sufficient signatures. Republicans hope the new districts could help them win a democratically held seat in the Kansas City area in November. From Washington, D.C., Associated Press, court questions limits on election spending. Conservative majority seems to back GOP against the restrictions. Conservative Supreme Court justices appeared to back a Republican-led drive Tuesday that would erase limits on how much political parties can spend in coordination with congressional and presidential candidates and overturn a quarter-century-old decision. A day after the justices indicated they would reverse a 90-year-old precedent limiting the president's power to fire independent agency heads, the court took up a 2001 decision that upheld a provision of federal election law that is more than 50 years old. The lawsuit, which originated in Ohio, includes Vice President J.D. Vance, who joined in the Republican challenge to the limits when he was a senator from Ohio. The case is the latest in which the conservative majority would upend congressionally enacted limits on raising and spending money to influence elections. The court's 2010 Citizens United decision opened the door to unlimited independent spending in federal elections. Every time we interfere with the congressional design, we make matters worse, said Justice Sonia Sotomayor, a dissenter in Citizens United and the court's other campaign money cases. From our National Digest in Washington, dueling health care bills could face Senate votes. The Senate headed toward dueling partisan votes on health care this week after Republicans said Tuesday they would unite around a plan that would allow COVID-19-era health care subsidies to expire. Both the Republican plan, which would replace the subsidies with a new savings account, and a Democratic bill, which would extend the enhanced Affordable Care tax credits for 3 years, lack the bipartisan support needed for passage. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican, South Dakota, said Tuesday the Democratic bill doesn't include enough reforms to curb fraud or limit high-income recipients. Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer of New York called the Republican plan dead on arrival. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, December 10th. Please stay tuned.